It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Big algae blooms are reappearing in the western basin, sometimes the central basin, of Lake Erie.
The blooms happen when excess nutrients, mostly phosphorus, run off into the lake from farms and sewage treatment plants. Some of these kinds of algae produce toxins that are among the most powerful natural poisons on Earth.
Over the past decade, these algae blooms have been common in that lake. Scientists predict climate change could make it worse. Rebecca Williams has the final part of this week's series on the warming Great Lakes.
See the green wave? Look. Okay. Look. See him? See him stirring it up? Look at his. Look at his wake over here.
Frank and Sandy Ben are taking us for a boat ride in Maumee Bay near Toledo. Sandy's the executive director of the group Lake Erie Waterkeeper. The water out here looks like pea soup. The algae that's blooming here is called Microcystis, and it produces a dangerous toxin. Sandy Ben says you wouldn't want to swim in it, and you shouldn't.
If your dog gets immersed in it and the toxins are there, it can kill the dog, a very good-sized dog. And then we know of someone, a person, who actually became sick with neurological disorders because of it.
Cities around here also pull their drinking water from the lake.
They have to treat the water more and take the algae out, and it costs them more. It increases the cost of the treatment process.
Last month, 2,000 people in a northwest Ohio township were told not to drink their tap water because levels of the toxin were so high. The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency says it's safe to eat the fish from the lake, but it recommends removing the guts and liver and rinsing the fillets in tap water first. Lake Erie is called the walleye capital of the world for a good reason. But people who fish for a living say the blooms have made things tougher for them. Paul Pachelski is the vice president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association.
When you have algae so thick that you could actually write your name with a fishing pole in it, people just think of it as going back to the 60s when it was called a dead lake.
The blooms they saw in the past are back. 2 years ago, there was an epic harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie that smashed all the records. Pachelski says he had to run his customers way out into the lake to get away from it. He burned through a lot more gas and a lot more money.
You lose business. You have people that will never come back.
There are a lot of big open questions about what these blooms mean for fish. Jeff Reuter directs Ohio State University's Stone Laboratory here on South Bass Island in Lake Erie. One thing researchers know for sure is that algal blooms can cause dead zones, places where there's no oxygen at the bottom of the lake.
So all the fish either move out or they're killed.
He says they're planning to study how the algal toxin affects fish and see if the blooms change their behavior. Reuter says climate change is expected to make these algal blooms worse. For one thing, the water is warming, and that favors blooms.
The other thing that we've seen is that the frequency of severe storms has greatly increased and is continuing to increase. The storms that produce more than 3 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, those storms have increased over 50% in the last 50 years.
He says when those heavy storms happen in the spring, they can flush phosphorus from farm fields into the lake. And all those extra nutrients can put the blooms on steroids. Farmers and fishermen and scientists are scrambling to find ways to solve this. The people who live and work on the lake are hoping it doesn't take too long. I'm Rebecca Williams.
You can hear earlier installments of our Great Lakes series at WPR.org/news. This is Central Time. When you drop that newspaper or empty can of soda in the recycling bin, do you ever think about where it ends up? Well, there's a good chance that your recycled products end up halfway around the world, and that means big bucks for some nations.
The global recycling industry can earn over $500 billion in a year. It employs more people than any other industry on the planet except agriculture. Our next guest took a closer look into that industry, from America to China and a lot of points in between. He's chronicled his experiences in a new book.
Adam Minter is the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and the author of the book Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
So glad to be here.
Well, there's that old saying that one man's trash is another man's treasure, and you walk us through this using the example of Christmas lights. It's a kind of a fascinating story. You never think about what happens when you throw them out, but what does happen? Tell us.
Right. Well, a few years ago when I was first really getting deep into this subject, I started visiting American scrapyards and finding piles of Christmas tree lights, sometimes that weighed several tons at a time in these junkyards. So I decided to follow them to China, and I ended up in a town called Shijiao, which is in southern China, a place where they recycle roughly 20 million pounds of American Christmas tree lights every year, and it could be much more. The reason those Christmas tree lights go to Shijiao and don't stay in the United States is because they don't have very much recyclable material in them. So American recyclers really don't have much of an interest, but China is the world's biggest raw material consumer of things that make up Christmas tree lights, things like copper and plastic, are happy to take that stuff. And the way they recycle them is they basically chop them up and they float the insulation off them using water, and the metal sinks to the bottom, and both products are then recycled.
And that's just an example of a wider trend, things that are trash here, not worth recycling in the United States, making their way to places like China or, as you write, India. How much is flowing across the oceans to be recycled in other countries?
Sure. Well, the United States last year recycled, and by recycle I mean it harvested about 130 million tons of recyclable products. Of that 130 million tons, 40% went overseas. That's the stuff that American factories and manufacturers weren't interested in using, or we simply didn't have the factories that could recycle that. And of that 40%, more than 25% of it flowed into China, which is actually the world's biggest recycling importer and, by sheer volume, the largest recycler in the world. So it's an extraordinary volume, and it's not just U.S. recycling that's flowing in there. It's all over the developed world, Japan, the EU, Australia, and even the developing world. So now places like Malaysia, Thailand, and even some Indian scrap is starting to flow into China because it just needs so much raw material.
Now, it's interesting because you look at recycling in the United States, and we look at it as sort of a badge of honor. Cities and individuals, when they recycle, that you're interested in going green, you care about the planet, that you have virtue. But in China, it seems like it's viewed more like a money-making venture, and that's why people are into recycling. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in the United States, we definitely, and in the European Union as well, we tend to think of recycling as an environmental good deed. But as I often tell people, you know, good intentions don't transform old beer cans into new ones. It's the desire to make new products. And you can't recycle unless somebody wants that thing you're recycling to turn it into something else. There's no recycling without consumption, and no consumption, frankly, without recycling. So if you go to a place like China, which is actually very resource poor, and it's also very poor in the sense that there aren't a lot of job opportunities available for everybody who wants them, it becomes sort of the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. So it's not just about importing recycling, but it's about going around and finding the things that even your neighbors can't find much use for and sort of repurposing them, or finding the people who can repurpose them into new things. In fact, China has a much higher recycling rate than the United States and the EU, and that pretty much goes universally across the developing world. If you can't find other work, you can always go and pick the valuables, frankly, out of the trash, and that's what's happening.
So recycling sounds like an environmental win in some ways, but you write about some environmental pollution issues that result from the way people are trying to strip these goods out of the products.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, I document, in one of the later chapters of the book, a place called Wenan, which was in northern China, about a three-hour drive from Beijing. It was basically northern China's largest zone for the recycling of plastics, and about half of those plastics came from Beijing, and half of those plastics were imported from around the world. It was likely one of the largest plastics recycling zones in the world, and it is without question the most polluted place I've ever visited, and I've visited some very polluted places. And the reason it was so polluted, it wasn't that people were burning, but there's just no wastewater treatment facilities for all of the caustic fluids that they use to clean these plastics before they recycle them. So people would throw them in, the nearest creek or the river. And then when you go into these plants where they actually would be melting these plastics into new ones, there's very little ventilation. And so I went and I spoke to a doctor in this town, and he was telling me that, in recent years, people started having strokes in their 30s and even 20s. And one of the reasons, after some investigation of it, was because they were essentially plasticizing their lungs as they were breathing in the fumes comes from these various plastics recycling equipment.
That sounds pretty severe. Is there evidence that those environmental costs and health costs are getting better in China?
You know, that's the interesting thing, they are. I mean, I've been covering this industry for 11 years based out of Shanghai. And I can tell you that, you know, in my 11 years in China in particular, there's been a general trend towards improvement. And there's a number of reasons for that. Number one, the price of labor in China is going up a lot. When I started covering this industry in 2002, a metal sorter, somebody who would just sort various fragments of metal into their respective piles would be paid about $80 a month. Now they're being paid in the range of $800 to $900 a month, and it looks like it's going higher. Well, if you're paying your employees that kind of money, you want to protect your investment because they've been trained, and you don't want to lose them to sickness or that kind of thing. So you actually see the working conditions improving. But the other thing that's happening is, you know, it's a great thing. Is take for example Christmas tree lights. At one time, the way you would recycle those would be just to set the pile on fire, burn off the insulation, and take the copper away. But now, because the price of oil has gone up so much, people want to recover that insulation to recycle it. So there's economic motivation. These economic motivations are really pushing things into an improved direction in China. But that's certainly not the case universally across the developing world. And the situation in India, in particular, is still quite abysmal.
We're talking with Adam Minter. He's the author of Junkyard Planet, about the global recycling trade, and we'll pick up that conversation coming up.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We're picking up our conversation with Adam Minter about the global recycling trade now. And Adam, I want to go back to those products from America that end up in China. I think you said something about 40% of our products end up there. Which ones?
Well, it depends to a certain extent on markets, but generally speaking, it's two kinds of things. If you're looking at metal, it tends to be the kinds of metals that are going to require more work to take apart. You need to actually extract the material. So, for example, if you have a factory, say, you know, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that's just generating really clean, clipped metal, you know, things that are cut from an engine block, say, that's going to stay at the scrapyard in Wisconsin. But if you take something like an electric motor, the sort of thing that would drive your washing machine or even an amusement park ride, that's filled with copper, but it's encased in steel, and so it's very hard for an American junkyard to pull that copper out, because that copper is worth about 3.25 per pound on today's market. So they'll actually send that overseas, and the Chinese are happy to, you know, to break apart those motors, and to this day, the labor's still cheap enough where they can do it affordably. So you'll see those kinds of things that take a little bit of work to actually extract the value out go over there. But the other thing you'll see are just things that you know, that China needs that we don't need as much of. So right now, the number one U.S. export by volume to China is cardboard and paper. And that's because China's the world's largest paper maker. And so we have an excess in the United States of fiber, as it's called in the global recycling industry. And that stuff will flow over there, and they'll use it to make newspapers and boxes, many of which flow, the boxes at least, flow back to the United States.
It seems counterintuitive that it makes financial, economic sense to ship this all the way across the Pacific Ocean, and it's still profitable once it gets there and all the labor goes into it to split out the needed ingredients.
Yeah, it does seem nonsensical. I agree with you, but there's actually a deep logic to it. And that really has to do, once again, with what I was saying earlier, consumption. As we all know, the United States runs a trade deficit with China, and that is because we import more stuff, more goods from China than they want from us. So what that means is the shipping containers, which are really the means of global trade in this day and age, we all know what they look like. They're 20 and 40-foot containers. They come over the ocean. When they come from South China, say, to the United States, they come with goods. But once they get to the U.S., there's really nothing to ship back in them. So what the shipping container companies do, because they want to get those containers back to China ASAP, is they discount them heavily so that they will go back. So today, as we talk, it costs about $2,400 to send 40,000 pounds of anything in a container from South China to Los Angeles. To go back the other way, from Los Angeles to South China, is only about $300. Those containers are going back anyway, so the shipping companies are just desperate to get whatever they can out of them. But that cheap shipping is essentially a tremendous subsidy to the recycling industry. It's a free ticket, basically, and it's free both almost in terms of money and in terms of energy to South China. So it actually makes a certain amount of economic sense indeed.
Is that the answer to the question, you know, why America isn't getting in on this and doing some of its own scrap recycling ourselves?
That's one reason. I mean, the other side of that is you know, it's very expensive to ship within the United States, I mean, by rail or by truck. So to ship from Los Angeles to Chicago on a rail car is about $2,400. So that means that a guy in South China, a scrap recycler down there, can actually pay more for a box of newspaper in Los Angeles than somebody in Chicago. So that's one reason. The other reason, though, is that, you know, it's the story of recycling is really, as I said, a story of consumption, and it's also a story of manufacturing. And as we all know, the American manufacturing base has been shrinking for all kinds of reasons. And meanwhile, the Chinese manufacturing base has been growing. So when you manufacture, you need raw materials. And as China's manufacturing base has grown, though, you know, amongst the raw materials of choice is American scrap metal. Most people, including me, when I first started working on this book, didn't realize just how much scrap metal in particular China uses. Well, China's the world's largest consumer of copper, and it goes into everything from iPods to your cookware. And the copper that it uses is about 50% recycled. The other 50% comes from traditional sources mined out of mountainsides. That's an enormous amount of copper, and it directly competes with the stuff that's coming out of mountainsides. And the U.S. is the top source for that scrap metal that goes into China's copper products.
You do visit some places in the United States that do some of this recycling, including, this blew me away, in my hometown of Belleville, Michigan. What led to that being a center for recycling?
Well, Belleville, Michigan is home to a company called Huron Valley Steel Company. And what they decided to do in the 1960s was figure out a better way to recycle the automobile. At the time, the way automobiles were being recycled as they are today is they're shredded into fist-sized chunks. And what happens with those chunks is you run a magnet over it, takes out all the steel, and back in the 1960s, the rest of it would be thrown into a landfill. Well, there was a brilliant entrepreneur at Huron Valley who said, we need to figure out a way to extract these other metals out of there. So we want to get the copper. We want the aluminum. We don't want this stuff in the landfill anymore. And they developed the technology, amazing technologies, to do that. What looks like a pile of garbage to you and me comes out once it goes through their Rube Goldberg of a system is individual hunks of aluminum, copper, and various items like that. But perhaps the most incredible thing to me, at least, having toured their facility, is what's called the coin tower. And this was explained to me when I went in there. The average American automobile, when it's shredded, is shredded with about $1.65 of change stuck between the seats and the floor mats. You know, it's an amazing statistic. Well, Huron Valley Steel figured out a way to extract all that change. And I've seen how it's done, and I can't tell you exactly how it's done, but it's amazing. And I've seen the piles, literally the piles and barrels of change that they're able to get out of American automobiles after they've been recycled. To me, it's the ultimate business in a sense. It's literally making money.
Well, I want to ask you, so let's say I'm here in America and I want to recycle my iPhone or my computer monitor. What is the right way to do that? And if there is a wrong way, what is that?
Well, you know, with the computer monitors, I mean, those are probably some of the computer monitors are what are called CRTs, cathode ray tubes, and they're in the same category as an old style television, and they're very difficult to recycle because they contain a lot of lead in the glass. And if somebody is offering to take that CRT from you for free, that's a flashing red light that something's wrong because it costs a lot of money to recycle one of those. So one of the things I tell people is if you want to recycle that computer monitor, recycle it with somebody who charges you to take it because it's going to cost them money to actually recycle it properly.
Really?
It's more difficult to say what to do with your iPod, your iPhone, all of your old electronics. You know, in the U.S., we have a very large electronics recycling industry, and they do a very good job, and this is a very new industry, it's only about 10 years old, of taking this stuff and making sure that it doesn't flow overseas. But there's a very good argument to be made that actually our electronics actually are recycled better overseas than they are in the United States. And that's because if you send an old iPhone, for example, to China, the first thing that's going to happen to it is it's going to be evaluated for whether it can be sold to somebody who can't afford a new one. And that's not just an iPhone 4S, say, which is Apple will market. The iPhone 2, the iPhone 3 have a market there. But if it can't be reused that way, it'll be taken apart piece by piece And if there are reusable components within it, they will be reused over there in new products. Now, if you recycle it in the United States, the way that an iPhone is recycled here is that it's shredded, much like a car. And that's fine. That means that nobody's going to set it on fire for the gold or the copper, but it also means you lose that reuse value. So these are very difficult questions for most consumers to have to answer. What is the better way to do this? It's not so black and white, or we could say black and green. These are very gray areas. But I do recommend that people who are looking for somewhere to recycle, look for certified recyclers, and one very good certification, and you can see it if you look up e-cyclers around the United States, is R2. They will make sure that you don't have your phones ending up in some of the more abusive workshops that you'll see in some of the documentaries we're all familiar with. They're filmed in South China.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We've been talking to Adam Minter, the author of Junkyard Planet.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the changes the Senate is making to filibuster rules when it comes to executive appointments.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about a lost city that exists in UW-Madison's Arboretum. That's in today's installment of Curious Wisconsin.
First, the U.S. Senate has officially gone nuclear. Earlier today, Democrats pushed through rules changes to the filibuster for certain presidential appointees.
This so-called nuclear option has been brought up in the past, but never acted on until today. Some are calling it a momentous step for a Senate that's often slow to change. Others are saying it's politically risky and could come back to bite the Democrats.
Joining us now to explain what happened is Gregory Koger. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Miami. Gregory, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So Democrats in the Senate have talked about doing this before, and at one point I believe Republicans did too, but why did it happen today?
Well, I think this is a culmination of a long process. As you mentioned, so the Republicans in 2003 to 2005 actually had a similar problem. The minority party was blocking their judicial nominees, and they eventually came up with a compromise. Over the last 5 years, the Democrats have also been frustrated by the minority party and have sought reforms. But in the past, they've settled for, sort of minor incremental reforms or promises of good behavior or, getting that one thing that they wanted released, like a one nomination or one bill. So I think today's actions are very much the culmination of that process, and like the culmination of all the frustration the Democrats have felt over the last 5 years, because there wasn't a lot of warning. So this wasn't like an attempt to sort of cow the Republicans into backing down on, these three nominations for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. It was, I think, really the decision that they were no longer going to play this game. And even if they had gotten the three nominations that they were fighting for today, I think the Democrats still would have, been sufficiently frustrated by everything that's occurred up to this point, but that they would have still wanted to go ahead and change the way the Senate works.
So under the new system, they can approve appointees with a majority, a simple majority. Who would this change apply to? Who would it not apply to?
It applies to all executive nominations. That means cabinet secretaries, lower-level executive branch nominations. And it also applies to federal district court judges and appellate court judges. So the only thing that's left, the only nominations that are still susceptible to a filibuster are Supreme Court nominations.
Republicans not happy about this happening. What kind of reaction have you seen from them so far?
The main talking point I've heard, well, two talking points. One is that they point out accurately that what today's actions exposes is that the rules of the Senate mean what a simple majority of the Senate say that they mean. And in that sense, it's a game in which the minority has no rights that can't be taken away. I think that's true. I think it was true yesterday, though. I mean, it's always been the case that the majority has this power. And so it has always been the case that the minority party should use its prerogatives in a way that the majority party will accept. And they have not done so. The current minority party has not done so in recent years.
On a wider perspective, a kind of a pro-con, there's been criticism of the Senate that it's slow, it's hard to get things done because of the filibuster rule. On the other hand, people say that's a good thing. It prevents a majority from running roughshod just because they've got 51 to our 49. Do you have a feeling, good or bad, on this?
Yeah, I mean, in the context of the broader debate, I've been sort of a moderate. Like, I actually do appreciate the value of filibustering in terms of it's a mechanism for preserving real debate in the Senate, which doesn't occur in the House. And it is a way to, you know, moderate legislation as it's moving through the House. I think there are two. But the other side of the argument is also quite strong. One is, which is, if you're using the power to obstruct just to tie up the Senate, just to keep anything from happening, just to slow everything down as much as possible to run out the clock, then I think that senators who are doing that are abusing the privilege in a way that doesn't advance the collective interest of the United States. And the other thing is similarly, if it's just a tool of political party, if it's just a way to keep the other party from passing their agenda, from passing things that are popular or that would, you know, improve the country, because you don't want them to accumulate a record of accomplishments, then also I don't think that the power to obstruct is serving the greater interests of the country.
Congress hasn't been noteworthy for bipartisan collaboration and collegiality lately. Does this make that even worse?
Probably. I mean, yes, almost certainly, right? The Senate Republicans can now and will now loudly say that the majority has gotten drunk with power. They're you know, stealing the classic prerogatives of the minority party in the Senate. They will say these things, and they'll probably feel them quite sincerely and act on that feeling. So, yes, in the short term, I do expect there'll be a little less comity in the Senate than we were observing. But that's a pretty low baseline, so I don't know how much we will miss as a consequence.
Mitch McConnell points out, hey, a couple years, maybe we run the place, and what you just did pays off for us. Do you think Democrats may regret this in 2 or 4 years?
It's entirely possible. I mean, again, my argument is that it's always been possible for this to happen, but certainly today's actions makes that explicit to everybody. And so, yes, it is entirely possible that, you know, in 2017, if there's a Republican president and Republican majorities in the House and Senate, that they might then say, well, remember when you did this thing, and now we're going to just we're going to do even more and eliminate all filibusters on legislation so we can get our agenda through as fast as possible. That is possible. And Democrats right now might anticipate that possibility and say, why should we allow filibusters against legislation now if in the future that right will be taken away from us? So we might as well just get rid of it now.
So the clock's ticking. We might lose control of the Senate. Let's pass as much as we can and just forget that whole filibuster thing as much as we can.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I think the fact that the House of Representatives has a majority of the Republican Party does sort of take away the incentive to eliminate legislative filibustering, because even if the Senate Democrats could get their legislation through the Senate exactly how they want it, it still would just end up sitting at the desk in the House of Representatives. So,
thinking about the long-term historical perspective here, is it wise to make a fundamental procedural change in response to this current crisis? Shouldn't we do this thing in a more deliberative fashion away from the hurly-burly of daily politics?
I know. I mean, I think when the senators observe that their rules just don't work and they sincerely feel like the interests of the Senate, the interests of the nation would be better served by changing the rules. They should do it then. I mean, the other side of the argument is, oh, we should wait until the beginning of a new Congress. But the problem then is that when you're enacting reforms, you're doing so in anticipation of bad behavior by the other side. And so it's always hard to know exactly how far you ought to go. Like if you knew in January 2009 that the Republicans would fight every comma of the Democratic agenda, then maybe Democratic senators might have been a little bit more ambitious in changing the rules of the Senate then. But they didn't know. And so if your argument is, you know, the only legitimate time to change the rules is at the beginning of a Congress, then you're sort of giving license to bad behavior by everybody else for the next 2 years, and then you don't solve the problem until long after it's been festering.
All right, Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Gregory Koger. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami.
Coming up next, we travel to Wisconsin's Lost City and find out about a neighborhood that never was.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's one of those places you hear rumors about, the lost city of the UW Arboretum in Madison. You might wonder, what's there and how did it get lost?
Today, in our Curious Wisconsin installment, we'll find out. Kathy Miner joins us. She's an Arboretum naturalist and guide. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the lost city?
Well, the Lost City, its official name was Lake Forest, and it was going to be a grand and elegant suburb running basically between Lake Wingra and Fish Hatchery Road. Covers quite a bit of land, which is now the Arboretum.
And how extensive is it?
840 acres is the number we're given, which is, if you think about it, about two-thirds of the present Arboretum, because our size is 1260 or so. So about a little over 1 square mile, maybe 1.3 square miles.
So why was this never finished?
Well, there were a variety of reasons, some having to do with the land and some having to do with people and some having to do with politics. And the part that had to do with the land was that they were building on swamp land. And though they did some homework, the developers, about how much fill they would need and what they would need to remediate, they miscalculated or underestimated. And so they didn't use enough fill, and roads literally sank, became covered with water. But the another big piece of it was that the bond company that was underwriting the Lake Forest Land Company, the operator of that bond company, was involved in fraud. He'd been in real estate fraud in Chicago before he came to Madison, unbeknownst to the Lake Forest developers. And when he left Madison, he engaged in some fraud out on the East Coast. So the bond company went under. The money had been used for other things. And so that was a big problem. And then the third piece of it was that because the Lake Forest Land Company operated between 1911 and 1922, World War I came along and drastically affected the national economy.
Now, you've actually been to this lost city. What does it look like if you stumble on it today?
Well, it's interesting. It would be possible to walk back there and not really know. Nature is taking the concrete paving back little by little. There are places where you can see concrete edges and you know you must be walking on an old road. But there are other places where they're really, really well hidden and you'd have to scrape away quite a bit of dirt or leaf duff before you would see any evidence.
And can you see it? Have people done flyovers and gotten aerial shots? Does it kind of stand out when you look at it from above?
It doesn't stand out. It wouldn't stand out anymore. Mm-hmm. There are aerial photographs done. We have one from 1937, and I believe there was one in the early 1950s. And, of course, now we have satellite photographs. But at this point, the forest is dense enough, and the undergrowth in particular is dense enough that you might never know. But there are a couple of crumbling foundations in the middle of the woods. And if you know where to find them, you can see concrete, moss-covered concrete front steps and remains of foundations.
Now, why wouldn't the Arboretum have removed that stuff? They know it's there. It's not what nature intended. Why is it still there?
Well, there were a half a dozen houses built between the present-day Martin and Carver Streets on the side streets that go between them, and those are still standing and surrounded by much newer homes, and so, of course, that is still a residential area. But I think it was probably a matter of expense of just simply not having the money or the labor available to tear up the old pavement and do the kind of remediation that would have been needed.
So when you're taking people on a tour of the Arboretum, along with the nature, is the Lost City part of the tour?
Once a year, we do a tour of the Arbor of the Lost City. It's always on the Sunday closest to Halloween. We make that association between the mysterious Lost City and possibly hauntings. And so it is on the last Sunday in October. And we start with a slideshow indoors with some photographs and some history of the thing, and then we go out and hike to it, and we find the pavement edges as we come across them. And then just that once, we do take people off our regulation trails, and we bushwhack around through the woods to find one in particular of the crumbling foundations. I have to say here that we really don't want to encourage people to be wandering around back there for their own safety and for the sake of the wildlife and the ecosystem that's back there. But once a year, we do sanction it, and it's really quite interesting. Lots of people show up. It's a very intriguing topic.
Now, you mentioned hauntings. Are there actual reports of hauntings at the Lost City?
I've actually heard of stories of hauntings and mysterious noises in some of the other wooded areas of the Arboretum. I'm not aware of any in there, but I will tell you that I was, before I started doing the tours of the Lost City area, I was back there once by myself doing some scouting, and it happened to be approaching sunset, and I was standing at this crumbling foundation and front steps, and a great horned owl began to hoot from quite nearby. And I didn't stick around a whole lot longer after that.
not a literal haunting, but a haunting sound.
Exactly,
anyway.
Yes.
So when I think of a name like Lost City, I want to picture an amateur Indiana Jones exploring around there. Do archaeologists or do local historians go in and try to find relics of the Lost City?
There is some interest, and actually we recently rediscovered another one of the foundations, and there are a few areas where there are kind of dirt piles where there might possibly be some things. And we were just recently in contact with the State Historical Society to see if they wanted to come and take another look or see if there were things of archaeological significance, because at this point there's quite a bit of much more modern day artifacts like beer cans or something like that around, mixed in with the material that might legitimately be from the early 20th century.
So it sounds like something that, you know, it's news to me. Has it been sort of a well-kept secret over the years?
Well, as I said, again, we don't really want to encourage exploring off the regulation trails, but on the regular sanctioned trails of the Arboretum, it is quite possible to see pavement edges and to see evidence that you're in something that was once going to be a residential development. But it's not, you could also really walk around there for quite a while and not have any idea.
So I'm assuming it's not okay if I want to take the kids and go try to find things and pick them up there, unless it's the beer cans. We're
right.
Welcome to those, I bet.
Right. It's okay, certainly, to be hiking on the regular trails in daylight hours. But any material that you find, I mean, I guess if it's clearly 21st century trash, that you'd be doing us a favor if you picked up the litter. But if you saw anything that looked like an old piece of pottery or an old bottle of any kind or something, really, you shouldn't be collecting any sort of material in the Arboretum, plant or animal material or anything, without a research permit, because we're a research area and institution. And so if you saw something like that, what we'd appreciate is that you make a note of the location the best you can and notify someone at the Arboretum so we can investigate it.
Surprised you would suggest that, Rob.
Very disappointed.
All right. I'll hang my head in shame.
Oh, it's so understandable. We know how intrigued everyone is.
Well, I want to ask you, if this thing had gone forward and there was this giant, you said it was intended to be very grand city in the Arboretum, would there be an Arboretum today? What would it be like?
Well, there certainly wouldn't be one of anything like the size it is. They planned more than 1,000 lots in this 840 acres. The lot sizes were small by today's standards. They would have been maybe 40 feet by 100 or so feet in size. But they planned in many elegant details. There were central circles with civic and public buildings in them, and every homeowner was to have water access in one way or another through a system of canals so that if you had a boat, you could get down to the water. There was a 9-hole golf course across Fitch Hatchery Road. They planned in many amenities, and it was supposed to be a really lovely place to live, at least according to the propaganda put out by the developers. But for, as we've discussed, a number of reasons, it didn't work out.
And I'm guessing, as an Arboretum guide, you're pretty happy with the way things did ultimately work out.
I won't pretend that I'm sorry that we now have a natural refuge and a green island in the middle of the city instead of more city. But I do understand some of the work that went into the project, and I find it a fascinating history.
Now, are you aware of other lost cities like these existing elsewhere in the country?
Not really. I'm sure there must be. It's like when you go out west looking for a ghost town or something, looking for places where plans were made that didn't quite work out.
All right, Kathy, thanks so much for joining us today and introducing us to the Lost City.
Thanks for the invitation. It was great.
That's Kathy Miner. She's a naturalist and guide at the UW Arboretum in Madison. She also helps Stephanie Elkins produce Simply Folk here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I think we might have to have her back next Halloween to hear about maybe ghost stories in the Arboretum. I get the feeling we just sort of scratched the tip of the iceberg there.
And do watch the Arboretum tour schedule for when that tour comes up in 2014.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Well, if there's something you are curious about in Wisconsin, let us know and we can try to get you some information on it. You can call the Central Time hotline. That number is 855-683-5422, 855-683-5422.
Or you can email us, centraltime@wpr.org.
Still to come today on Central Time, our guest explores the rise of Rupert Murdoch's media empire. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a unique perspective on immigration reform in the United States. Our guest says states should compete to bring in the most immigrants to boost their economies.
First, Rupert Murdoch's media empire spans the globe, including Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, The Times of London, and much, much more. Our next guest traces the rise of that empire and recent scandals that threaten it. David Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks guys so much for having me.
Let's jump to the beginning of Rupert Murdoch's media career. What did he learn as an Australian newspaper publisher that led to his incredible international success?
Well, I think he learned a sense of, being willfully blind to the restraints that were imposed on him. I mean, here's a guy who basically time and again found ways to push up against the regulations on what he was allowed to invest in, on what he felt were the unfair public subsidies of public broadcasting in Australia, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which ended up being a powerful player, not just in radio, but television, and who in took lessons about that to places like Britain, where it was seen that an Australian-born guy who was a tabloid news editor, he took over the News of the World and the Sun there and turned them from struggling titles into the nation's most popular newspapers, that a guy like that shouldn't be allowed to own two of the nation's most prestigious papers. And he sort of pushed against what people saw his limitations on how many papers one person should own, and he just sort of steamrolled it through. And time and again, he's done the same thing with television holdings, both in the UK and the US. So I guess what he took there was sort of a healthy disdain for the idea that simply because people had limitations in place, that he should accept the world as it's been designed, and instead tried to conform others the way he thought things should be situated.
And it's not just regulations. In a lot of ways, the customs of media, he thought, no longer applied, right?
Well, here's a guy who introduced to the British tabloids, which were already, you know, papers that often like to focus on crime and scandal, but he really upped the ante, making it a much crueler, I think, a much more tougher, at times more punitive sport. Both, you know, not only in Australia and the UK, but here in the U.S. with the New York Post. For a time, he owned the Chicago Sun-Times and the Boston Herald as well. And, you know, that tabloid blood is coursing through the veins of Fox News, even if its political stripes are a little more conservative than even his own right-of-center views.
And those tabloids, in all those cases you just mentioned, and on to Fox News, got influence over the national governments in Australia, in the UK, here in the United States. Was that a conscious strategy of Murdoch's?
Yeah, look, he's genuinely a creature of the political right. He is a conservative guy, reflexively in many ways, although his views, as I mentioned, aren't really as conservative as some of the most popular figures on Fox News. But, you know, one of his sources of influence and genius politically, in some sense, is that he really is willing to throw the support of his newspapers to major figures of both major political parties in all three of these great English-speaking nations. So he'll toggle back between, you know, Democrats of the center-left, like Hillary Clinton running for Senate in 2000 and again in 2006 here in New York State, where, you know, the New York Post supported her. And then to people on the right, you know, Republicans can otherwise get supports. Tony Blair, a figure of the center left, he sort of cast aside some of the Labour Party in the UK's socialist traditions and history to form a more centrist company. And he left John Major in the Conservative Party, Murdoch did, and swung his four newspapers to the side of Blair. And when he thought that Blair's partner, rival, and successor, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, was spent, he then switched his papers over to support the Conservative Party of David Cameron, who's now the Prime Minister. And this accomplishes a couple things. I mean, among other things, it means that both parties kind of have to stay on their toes because both of them have hopes of winning his endorsements. You know, the New York Times is unlikely to endorse a Republican for office anytime soon. The Wall Street Journal is unlikely to endorse a Democrat for presidency anytime soon. And that's a Murdoch publication that's a bit more conservative on its editorial pages than Mr. Murdoch himself is. But the tabloid here, the New York Post, and his newspapers throughout the rest of his English-speaking empire really are willing to toggle back and forth, and that gives him so much more influence than if it was predictably one party or the other.
You mentioned the Wall Street Journal, and at some point he started taking the money that his corporation made from those tabloids and buying prestige papers, the Times of London, Wall Street Journal, and others. Why did he make that jump?
Well, he's always played sort of a two-level game when it came to newspapers. You know, he makes his money through the tabloids and shapes popular opinion and sort of sets the acceptable realm of discourse for the publication, for the public at large, through his tabloids, which have these big readerships. And then he reaches elites and shapes, you know, discourse for them through by owning these prestigious papers. So in Australia in 1964, there was no general interest newspaper for the country at large. In 64, he created what was called The Australian, which is sort of as though it's the Wall Street Journal if its news pages had more of its opinion interlaced into its coverage. In the UK, he picked up the Times of London and the Sunday Times. And you're right, the Times of London has never made him a dime. You know, The Australian is unprofitable. The Wall Street Journal is barely profitable, but the New York Post, you know, he first bought it in 1977, I believe it was, and he's never made a dime off the Post either. But these papers help him to reach a wide audience and also to reach an audience that is viewed by politicians as their voters. And so he shapes the elite opinion with things like the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, the Australian, and he reaches the public, which these bigger tabloids. But there's one more element. You know, in recent years, even his big circulation papers have seen their revenues really decline. And one of the great values of having this influence at the top levels of government in all three of these major countries is that these are the same guys who make the decisions that can affect Murdoch's highly regulated holdings in, you know, cable television and in broadcast TV as well, and satellite TV. And as a result, you have people who feel that they owe you favors, who are in position to do you great benefits. And those, until this year when he split the company in two, those broadcasting and entertainment and television revenues really subsidized the losses at places like the Times of London and the New York Post.
When Rupert Murdoch starts or takes over an existing media outlet, how much of a stamp does he personally put on it?
He puts a great deal. You know, he was once asked under oath in England, about what he believed. And he said, anyone who wants to know what I think, is welcome just to read the Sun tabloid every day. And in this country, it would pretty much hold true for the New York Post. It's kind of a anti-elitist, it's right of center, it's brawling, it likes to treat, it likes to cover sports, it likes to treat celebrities as sport, it likes to treat politicians as sport, you know, the inherent assumption that most of them are either philanderers or crooks or both, and it's his belief that behind closed doors people are cheating the everyday people that he alone somehow has a connection to. When he bought the Wall Street Journal, though, you know, the first weeks and months he was in the newsroom here in Midtown Manhattan, and he was looking at headlines. I guess actually initially it was downtown near the old Financial Center before they moved it up close to our offices here in Midtown Manhattan. But, you know, he would go through and he'd look at headlines and layouts, and suddenly you saw a lot more color photographs, incorporated into the front page and the section fronts. You saw bigger headlines and bolder language used and fewer really long pieces from the front page. And all of that is consistent with what his editors that he brought in, you know, advised, but it was also very consistent with the man himself. And, you know, when it comes to his tabloids, he really talked to those guys on an almost daily basis. You know, it was as though the sun never set on Murdoch's empire. I was told by the former editor and publisher of the New York Post that in the days before email and caller ID on phones, that you know every editor had two phones on his or her desk, and they were almost all men. The first phone would be the phone that your secretary would route all your calls to, and the second phone was like a bat phone that only Rupert, and if you were feeling very brave, maybe your spouse would also have the number to, and that, you know, he would call if it was morning in Sydney, Australia, he would call that phone. If it was morning in London, he'd call the Sun or the News of the World. If it was morning in New York or Chicago or Boston, he'd call those phones, and he was always, every hour available to him awake was an hour to call his tabloid editors and say, you know, Murdoch here, what do you have? What do you know?
We're talking to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik about his new book on Rupert Murdoch's media empire. It's called Murdoch's World.
And you can join in. Do you have a question about Rupert Murdoch or thoughts about the impact he's had on media and politics? Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation with a look at some of the scandals facing that media empire coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.